You're listening to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, episode 98. Welcome to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, where we bring you engaging conversations about conservation and wildlife. I'm your host, Matt Podolsky. Our guest on today's show is Jake Keel. Jake is the director of the new documentary film, Death by a Thousand Cuts, which is about illegal charcoal production in the Dominican Republic and the trafficking of this charcoal to neighboring Haiti. It's an intense and powerful film, and Jake's story about how he became inspired to launch the project is also particularly fascinating. As you'll hear in the interview, Jake's career in conservation actually began in the tourism sector, and I really enjoyed hearing about how this experience was translated into filmmaking and storytelling. Let's jump in.
My name is Jake Keel. I am vice president of the Grupo Punta Cana Foundation in the Dominican Republic, and I'm also the co-director and producer of the documentary film Death by a Thousand Cuts.
Awesome. So, Jake, how long have you been living in the Dominican Republic? And maybe you can explain your connection with this Caribbean island nation.
Sure. So I've been working full-time in Punta Cana for almost 12 years. And essentially, the island sort of was, it seemed like it was almost my destiny to work here. When I was 16 years old, I did a study abroad in high school in the Dominican Republic. I lived with a family in San Cristobal, which is a city outside of the capital city of Santo Domingo. And I had studied Spanish, but really had never used it and had never tried to converse or interact with people in Spanish. I'd basically just been studying it. And the warmth of the Dominican people really is what drew me into learning Spanish, learning more about, you know, Latin American cultures, about the Caribbean, because the people were just so warm and friendly and inviting, and you could just feel this like genuine, you know, hospitality about the people. But I really just couldn't communicate with anyone when I first got here. So from then on, you know, I sort of dedicated my, you know, travels and career and life to visiting places in Spanish-speaking countries and in Latin America. And I always just kept getting drawn back to the Dominican Republic for different reasons. So I did community service projects in the Dominican Republic. I've done research here for my master's work at Cornell. And since then, I've now been working in the tourism sector for close to, you know, 12 years.
Very cool. So tell me a little bit about, you know, this role that you currently play. I mean, what you're doing out there in Punta Cana.
So in Punta Cana, we are one of the first resort developments in the Eastern Dominican Republic. Started 47 years ago, and it was essentially shortly after the fall of the Trujillo dictatorship in the late 60s, a group of American investors bought a chunk of land in the Eastern Dominican Republic where there was really no population, no roads, no energy, no electricity, water, no infrastructure, and not even really cities. It was basically some small towns. And they met up with a young Dominican, pretty precocious guy named Frank Ranieri. And Frank Ranieri was really the first one that made the suggestion to them that this land that they had purchased, which was cheap in certain sense, it was 30 square miles of virgin or somewhat virgin forest and coastline. He made the suggestion that this could be developed for tourism. Now, today that seems really obvious because Punta Cana is one of the fastest growing tourism destinations in the Caribbean. 40,000 hotel rooms just in our region alone. We get 3 million arriving passengers to the region through our airport. And, you know, it's become this huge economic hub for the Dominican Republic. But in 1969, in post-Trujillo Dominican Republic, there really wasn't a lot of tourism in the country. I think there was 1,500 hotel rooms total for the entire island. And it was not a place that people went to because, you know, it was like you, after a dictator, it's not exactly attractive for a, you know, a vacation destination. There wasn't airlift, there wasn't rooms. And so Ranieri basically made this suggestion to the group of investors. They took him up on it. They started with some small hotel developments. They eventually sold a chunk of land to Club Med, and Club Med was in sort of the beginning stages of their development, all-inclusive resorts. And then Club Med and Punta Cana got into business starting the first private international airport really in the world. And that was really the big innovation that really turned the corner for this region. There was no way to get here. And all of a sudden, they started an airport and they got a few flights. It was inaugurated in the 80s. And then they got a few more flights. And then as they got more airlift, there's so much beautiful white sand beach in this end of the island, started attracting international hotel chains. And then all of a sudden you have, you know, major tourism development in this area to the point where now it's, you know, it's a massive tourism destination. And so that was really the beginnings of Punta Cana. And so I give you that background basically because our company still owns and operates the international airport, we're very dependent in terms of our economic success on the success of the whole region. Right. So if the Punta Cana hotels, not even hotels that we own, if they're no longer successful, we'll have a lot less air traffic at the airport. And so we'll be less successful. And so we have a vested interest in the long term sustainability of the region. And so our company invests really heavily in sustainability and in the local community, education, health, water systems, environmental protection, as a self-preservation mechanism and as a, you know, business security mechanism. And so I head up all of our sustainability program.
Very cool. Yeah.
And feel free to interrupt anytime. I could talk about Punta Cana all day.
No, I mean, that's good. And I do want to sort of delve a little bit into, you know, what you're doing and in, you know, these sustainability programs that you're involved with and that you're running in the region. Because, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people, when they think of tourism development, like, that's sort of the last thing that they would envision is a part of that, is like sustainability and environmental conservation. So, you know, and I mean, you talked a little bit about how those two things are connected. But, you know, yeah, tell me a little bit more about these programs and you know, why this is, like, why it's so important, why there is this connection between environmental conservation and sustainability and tourism.
Well, in a place like the Dominican Republic, the major attractions, I mean, even for me, the main reason I started coming to the country and was so attracted to the Dominican Republic in the first place was, you know, the warmth of the people, the hospitality. I loved the culture. Right, the music, the food, the dance, the, you know, the language, the expressions, like the uniqueness of Dominican culture, and then also the, you know, the natural resources. This island has an incredible diversity of habitats, of mountain ranges, of species that only exist here, and so those are a major attraction for tourism. You know, the natural resources and the human resources, right? So the culture and the environment are what draw people here in the first place. So in our view, if you're not investing in, you know, improving the lives of the people that work at your resort, and if you're not investing in protecting the environment that attracts people in the first place, then you're probably not going to be successful over the long term. So that's really how we do it. And so we, you know, in a very practical sense, our foundation, we've integrated solid waste management programs. We call it zero waste. The idea being that everything we produce, whether it's what arrives in the international flights or is produced in our hotels or in our private home residences, we try and find some use for that. Normally what you would consider garbage, we try and find some productive use for it. So we sell recyclables. We have a large scale composting program. We have waste classification in our hotel kitchens and in most of our private homes. And the idea being that right now, you know, we're not zero waste, but we're diverting close to 58% of all the garbage we produce within our resort, including the international airport, from going to a local landfill. And those are pretty solid numbers for waste diversion. And for us, it makes a lot of sense. It saves us money in waste hauling. It protects our water source because we have some real weaknesses in the landfillings here, the landfill systems here. So for us, it makes sense to invest in these kind of things. We invest a lot of money and a lot of effort and a lot of staff time in coral reef protection and restoration. We have one of the largest coral reef nurseries, in-water nurseries in the Caribbean. We mostly work with staghorn coral, although we're starting to diversify with other species. We have a number of no-take fishing zones, and we work with the local fishermen to hire them to get them into more tourism-related activities and less pure fishing, exploitative activities. So basically everything that we see that's related to the environment that currently could be a risk for us as a business, we try and find some way to build some kind of sustainability into it, that we find, whether it's finding alternatives for fishermen, implementing a waste management program, protection of endangered species. We have a diverse roster of programs.
It strikes me, and again, like, you know, I guess I'm sort of curious to know how this approach and this model for developing, you know, tourism industry in this part of the Dominican Republic and the Caribbean, are there other groups that are working in a similar space, or I mean, is what you're doing? Do you guys sort of feel like you stand apart from other tourism developments in the Caribbean? Are there other folks that are sort of looking at what you're doing and trying to sort of emulate that?
Yeah, you know, I think there are different scales of this, right? So there are eco lodges or small scale ecological hotels or eco resorts that have, you know, programs, whether it's, you know, water saving in the rooms or the towel reuse program or local purchasing of materials and supplies and food. There's lots of certifications, lots of hotels doing different things. But I think what makes us unique is, one, we're so big. You know, we have close to, you know, 2,500 employees directly for our company, plus there's another 2,000 to 3,000 employees that work for other companies but only work with us, you know, people that provide services in the airport. So really, you know, we are quite unique in the sense that we own and operate an international airport. We have golf courses and private residential communities. We have hotel properties. And because of the way that this region has developed, we have our own electric company. We have our own water distribution company. We have a water treatment facility for our resort, and we recycle all of the water for use on the golf courses. We have our own recycling center where we classify, you know, in the high season, anywhere between 25 to 30 tons of garbage a day. So we have all these unique programs. So what makes us different than a lot of other, you know, ecologically friendly hotels is that we're not just a hotel. We're a whole complex. We influence the value chain of tourism in all different ways. And I think that's what makes us unique. And what we've tried to do, again, because the success of other hotels in our region is so critical to our success financially, we've tried to share our experience. Now, we don't run some of these all-inclusive hotels. We're not in charge of their operations. We're not the government, so we can't tell them what to do. But we try and share best practices. We try and encourage best behavior. We try and facilitate that there's solutions for some of these challenges from some of the hotels. And, you know, frankly, we've published business case studies about our waste management program. We share all of our data related to our reef restoration program. You know, we're very open about having visitors come and visits from other companies and universities and, you know, governments come and see what we do and, you know, try and learn from what we're doing and, you know, basically turn it into a learning experience. So I think that also makes us quite unique.
At this point, I'm very curious to hear about how this role you're playing in, you know, essentially ecotourism, right? I mean, how this evolved into an interest in filmmaking and storytelling, right? So, I mean, you know, maybe you can tell us, I assume there must be a story about where the original idea for your film, Death by a Thousand Cuts, came from.
For sure. Well, so basically, I've been in the Dominican Republic for 12 years, and, you know, I had, when I started, my background is in environmental management. My interest is in conservation of species and of habitats. And I got into tourism because I thought there was a really unique opportunity to gain experience in a private sector setting, but really pushing environmental ideals in this private sector setting. I never really wanted to work for the government. I'm not really a fan of having to, you know, really be limited by, you know, some of the restrictions of government. I really wanted to have sort of a laboratory for experimentation. And in some ways, you know, the private sector is a good place to do that. There's a lot of open space to operate in terms of environmental issues because there's not a lot of really solid experience here. So that's where I got my start. It was in tourism, and I really had no background in tourism before I came to Punta Cana. And so I started applying some of the ideas that I had learned at Cornell and some of the things that I was learning from what other people were doing in different private sector businesses and applying it here. But I had done my master's research work in the Southern Dominican Republic in a mountain range called the Sierra de Bauruco. And that area for me was sort of a life-changing experience. The Sierra de Bauruco is a paleo island, meaning it at one point was separate completely from the island of Hispaniola. So islands typically have a much greater diversity of species and endemism, species that only exist on an island, than other places, than mainland continents. And Hispaniola, you know, Dominican Republic and Haiti has a really high endemism of species. But the Sierra de Bauruco mountain range had an even more acute species endemism. So it had a really high diversity of species. It was this beautiful mountain range. It's just stunning, that starts on the coastline and heads up into the mountains. And that's where I decided to do my master's work. But it became really apparent, even in 2001, when I started doing the work, that this mountain range was being heavily impacted. And it wasn't being heavily impacted in the way that you think of for a lot of tropical forest, where they're, you know, cleared massively for agriculture or for grazing cattle or for production of soy. It wasn't these large scale clearings. It was something much slower and more gradual and piecemeal. And it was these sort of small chunks of forest in the highlands that were just disappearing. And then when the rains would come, it would wash away the soil and they would stay bare. And so you had these sort of steep slope mountains that all of a sudden had missing patches. And those missing patches kept expanding and increasing. And so I became really intrigued by that. And then I also was really interested that here was this national park in the Dominican Republic, which is, you know, it's a developing country, but it's fairly well off for compared to many other developing countries. It's now considered a mid-income country. And it shares its border with Haiti, which is notoriously a very poor country with a lot of problems politically and economically. And this national park was right sharing the border with Haiti. And so you have this terrific, amazing biological resource right on the border of an area with this tremendous poverty. So I thought that, you know, contrast was really striking. And then you had, as we discovered, there was two major threats to the park. One is the invasion of agriculture, large-scale agriculture for production of avocados or for shifting agriculture of different crops, you know, subsistence crops and, you know, seasonal crops. And then you have this production of charcoal. And the charcoal, it was fascinating to me because it's a product that's not widely used in the Dominican Republic. And practically you don't see charcoal anywhere. And the ovens themselves are made very discreetly deep in the forest, hidden from view. And so you have these secret production of charcoal, but it's having this impact on the forest. And almost all of the charcoal produced is then sent to Haiti, to nearby Haiti. And so we thought that was a really interesting contrast. You have one country which has this biological, ecological wealth, and it has, you know, these forests and a national park right on the border. And then the other side, you have this acute poverty. You have a real need, and people rely on charcoal as cooking fuel. And so we thought we would look into that issue and figure out, you know, what are the challenges there and what are the risks for both of these countries? And, you know, is there a potential for this turning into something more important, a bigger risk and with greater consequences for both countries?
And so, I mean, at what point did you start thinking that there was a story to tell here and that maybe you were the one to tell that story?
Yeah, so I was really interested in the idea. I had no background really in film. And so what I decided to do was apply for a Fulbright grant, a Fulbright scholarship, and to do an academic study on this area of the Sierra de Bauruco and do sort of documentation by transects, but using multimedia as the means, you know, as rather than writing sort of a really interesting paper on, you know, with the deforestation of the Sierra de Bauruco and the production of charcoal, decided it would be really interesting to try and document it visually with photographs, with video, with interviews of local people, and sort of travel along transects to do this work. And when I applied for the Fulbright, I did a lot of work. I had, you know, really good access to information. There'd been quite a few studies in this area. And when I was in the process of applying, I sort of turned myself into somewhat of a quasi-expert on the subject. And then I didn't get the Fulbright. But in the process of applying, I started talking to a friend of mine who's a, you know, documentary film producer, Ben Selko, who works, you know, he's worked on projects all over the world. He's worked for CNN, for HBO, for Netflix, for, you know, many different TV channels. He's done, you know, feature-length documentaries. And he's got a lot of experience, and he sort of asked me just casually what I was up to, and I told him about my proposal. And he said, you know, if you're going to dedicate all this time and effort and resources to something academic, you know, we should really think if this has potential as a film. And that's really how it started. He and I wrote a proposal, sort of a film treatment document, and then I brought him down on frequent flyer miles, and we did a road trip through the city of Arauco. We covered almost 600 kilometers of land, drove all over the place, and started interviewing people and talking and sussing out whether there really was a potential for a story there. And we discovered ultimately that we thought there really was. And so we were able to get some initial financing as a grant from the embassy of Holland in the Dominican Republic. And we started putting together ideas and our story. And that's when the murder happened. This was in 2012. And the murder was a Dominican park ranger who went to apprehend a Haitian charcoal producer in the national park. And there was some kind of conflict between the two of them. And they end up getting into some kind of fight or argument. And the end result was that the Dominican park ranger, Melanio, was murdered by machete by the Haitian charcoal producer, and so that became sort of our entrance into this bigger story. You know, the idea that there could be conflict between Dominican Republic and Haiti, that the natural resources were sort of a touch point for these two countries. One had much better access to natural resources and in better shape than the other, and we thought that there was a sort of a poignant tale to be told through this murder.
Absolutely. And you know, I had the opportunity to see your film when I was down in the Dominican Republic at the Environmental Film Festival that is hosted down there. And I mean, it is a really sort of powerful way to enter that story. You immediately like get to know this person's family, and you're introduced to all these characters, and you're introduced to this issue like right off the bat. And, you know, your film, it's sort of, you know, I mean, sort of like you said, it starts with this one incident, and then it just sort of expands into this, you know, much larger scale issue than, you know, I really ever could have imagined, you know, this topic of charcoal production could have become. And I do want to sort of delve into like a little bit about the scale of this issue and you know, where the story sort of went and how the scope of things really expanded. But before we go there, I am curious. I want to ask you about your actual approach towards putting this film together, because what you have now is a feature-length film in Death by a Thousand Cuts. But you guys started off by producing a short film, right? Tell us a little bit about that approach.
Yeah, so when you're making a documentary film, we knew from the beginning that this wasn't the type of story that we could come in with a huge crew and a huge team and just knock out in, you know, a handful of visits. Like, we knew that in order to get access to folks, to get them to tell us their story, to really feel comfortable with us, and to really, you know, share intimacy about their lives and about their experience in this area, that it was going to take a number of visits, it was going to take time, and it was going to take kind of a lot of, you know, investment of, you know, personal investment from our part. And so we didn't have resources when we started the project, and we knew that we would need them eventually. But what we wanted to do is take the initial resources we got and produce a concept paper of what the full film would look like. And so we did an 18-minute sort of teaser, and that 18-minute teaser basically showed what the film style would be like, the quality of the filming, the type of visuals that we wanted to capture. We really were seeking to make a sort of personal drama thriller that could then be translated into sort of a documentary with an environmental messaging. So if for us, it was really important to kind of get something out that we could share, and that would serve as sort of our proposal to get investors and get interest from, you know, potential sponsors of the film. And that's essentially what happened. So we put together this 18-minute sort of teaser. Then we showed it at a few small venues. We got some interest, and then eventually the project was acquired by Participant Media and Univision. It was a partnership they had together for documentary content. And then we also took advantage of a film incentive law in the Dominican Republic, which allows companies to invest in film projects as long as, you know, they comply with a certain number of requirements. And so we were able to get resources from the film incentive law and then from the Participant Media and Univision partnership. And that's really how we got to really get into doing more visits to the border, more visits into the families. We got into Haiti quite a bit. We were able to do, get a little more specialized with the type of equipment we were able to use. And we were able to, you know, really kind of delve into the project and spend, you know, good quality time on the edit and put together the product that we were able to at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like I've said before, I mean, it's a really powerful film. And, you know, one of the most striking things, I think, is how you sort of, you know, you really grab the attention of the audience by introducing this issue, this park ranger who was murdered that you talked about. But then you take this issue surrounding illegal charcoal production, which at the beginning of the film, it seems like this like small sort of localized issue. And as the film progresses, I mean, it really just blows up, and you show how it's affecting the politics of the entire country and the whole region. You know, I just wonder, like, I mean, you explained before about how this incident with this murder, you know, sort of immediately upon that happening, like, that shifted your approach towards telling the story, right? So, I mean, I guess I'm wondering, like, you know, beyond that original intent, like, that murder that really starts the story, to what degree were you reacting to events as they were playing out around you and as this issue was developing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the process of making a documentary. We started with an idea that there was, for example, just small producers of charcoal that were, you know, kind of opportunistically getting into the national park and making charcoal and then, you know, using it for their own consumption. And then as we got in to look at this in more detail, we found that it was quite different. They were entering into the national park to make charcoal, but then it was becoming a commodity that they were sending to the urban areas in Haiti. And that was what was, you know, actually it was income for them. They weren't just using this charcoal for their own subsistence. And we also found, for example, that in other parts of the Dominican Republic, there was large scale charcoal, you know, wood charcoal production out of forest that was being sent to Haiti, but it was, you know, being done by Dominicans, and the trade and the trafficking was controlled by Dominicans. And it was no longer something that was just opportunistic of, you know, a poor farmer going into the national park to make some kind of, you know, living. It was actually, you know, much bigger industries that were operated almost sort of like a mafia. And so a lot of that was just the process of discovery and investigation of a documentary. You know, we went in with kind of a general idea of what we thought, and then it turned into obviously to much more. And so that's kind of what happened with the murder. You know, we never contemplated that there was, you know, that this murder was going to happen. This happened after we had, you know, started putting together the project, you know, and it was just timely. I mean, it's tragic and timely in the sense that it helped us tell this story. And then, you know, other things happened that were serendipitous in a way. You know, there's a Dominican law that went into effect as we were, you know, kind of finishing the filming in 2013, 2014, where, you know, it was a law that restricted immigration to the Dominican Republic and largely was geared towards impacting Haitians that were coming to the Dominican Republic looking for a better life. And that happened to fall into the realm of our story because the widow of the park ranger who was murdered, Melanio, the widower was Kalina, was a Haitian woman. and their children were half Dominican and half Haitian, and they lived on the border and were under threat of being deported under this new law. And so these were things that when we started in 2012, weren't on our radar at all. They weren't things we were thinking of. It weren't things that had been, kind of in our mindset about this at all. And then all of a sudden they became really relevant issues and really important issues that had to be covered. And so that's, I think, part of the process of, making a documentary. It's part of the process of discovery and exploration. It's one of the things that, we were fortunate in some ways that these activities all occurred in the time period of the film, and it wasn't something that we would, have to talk about in the director's cut later on. These were things that happened in real time. That gave our story, with kind of some impact and a level of, of realness that really, I think, helped tell this personal story, but then turn it into something much more polemic.
Yeah, and that you brought into play, you mentioned this, this new law and which brought up all these issues over citizenship and in the Dominican Republic and led to lots of deportations. And watching your film, you're following this character, the wife of the park ranger who was murdered right at the beginning of the film, and you're following her throughout the film, and then at the end, you find out that she's getting deported, and it's crushing, right? I guess what I'm wondering is, a lot of environmental films, conservation documentaries, they work to expose this issue, and then at the end of the film, you reach this point where there's sort of this almost like a resolution, right? Where it's like, but like, here's the potential solution, like here's what here's what you can do, or here are things that are, actions that are being taken to help resolve this issue, right? But like, you guys don't have that, right? I mean, your film ends, and I think sitting in that screening room at the screening that I attended at the Dominican Republic Environmental Film Festival, I mean, it just, you could feel like the anger in that room, right? Of like, this grave injustice is like being perpetrated on these people, and it's like, what do we do about this, right? I guess I'm just wondering, like, there must have been like a lot of thought going into like the tone of the piece and like how you wanted to end it.
Yeah, and we did this very much on purpose, and we really thought about it a lot, because one of the frustrations, and I can now say I'm a filmmaker, but even just as a environmentalist who watches a lot of documentary films with environmental subjects, one of the great frustrations is that you present these very complex and difficult and complicated issues, and it takes you the better part of the movie to explain them, but then in order that the viewer feels okay with what they're seeing, you kind of tack on something about what they can do at home, and they can recycle, and they can screw in an incandescent light bulb, and and they can donate to Nature Conservancy, and that'll solve the problem. And these are just much bigger problems. And what our message really wanted to be was that these are big challenges. This is important for the identity and the future of this country. These are lessons that are incredibly important, not just for the island of Hispaniola and Dominican Republic and Haiti, but for other places as well. And we wanted to leave people with sort of a pit in their stomach and feel like, wow, this, we got to get on this. And in fact, since this film has come out and we've screened it all over the Dominican Republic, I've given talks about it all over the Dominican Republic. We've gone and visited with politicians in the United States. We have a screening with the major political party of the Dominican Republic tomorrow. So we're really pushing this hard as an element for change. And that's one of the things that's been, I think, the most impactful part of the film, is that it's the conversation and the dialogue that comes after the film. We don't leave you feeling settled and happy that, this problem's all set because we're all just going to make a donation and, recycle. Really, there's big challenges that need to be thought about, and there needs to be engagement, and there needs to be some level of empowerment of people in the Dominican Republic and Haiti to hold their politicians and their governments to task and demand that there are better treatment of the people, that there's more priority put on the natural areas, that there's better policies for producing products and jobs that aren't impacting the environment so profoundly. And so I think that was kind of our intention, and it's something we're pretty proud of. You know, a lot of times you get into these films, you know, even Al Gore, as terrific as Inconvenient Truth was, there's a lot of environmental groups that are incredibly frustrated that just made it seem like, you know, these problems are totally solvable and approachable. And, you know, when we can just do our little piece and it's all going to be all set. Well, it's been over a decade since that film came out. And guess what? Things have not gotten a lot better. And we need a lot more urgency to these problems. And that was kind of our intention.
Yeah, and I mean, it definitely had an effect on me. I mean, it was very, very powerful. I mean, I guess you talked a little bit about, you know, the screenings that you've started doing in the Dominican Republic and how you're screening this for politicians and stuff. I mean, this the film is very critical of like the political system and politics in the Dominican Republic. I mean, I wonder like what kind of reaction you're getting. I mean, what are these discussions that have happened thus far? I mean, what are folks talking about and what kind of reaction are you getting from politicians, but I mean also just the general public and like people who are coming to these screenings?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. The when I first, before the film was even out and we'd only done some sort of small-scale private screenings, I was invited by the American Chamber of Commerce in the Dominican Republic in Santo Domingo to give their talk at their monthly luncheon, and they get a lot of press and they get, you know, sort of the top business leaders in the country to come. And, you know, I didn't even present the film. I just presented some of the issues in the film, the large scale production of charcoal, both by Haitians in the national park, but also by, you know, Dominican controlled entities and, you know, individuals throughout the country, and the exportation to Haiti. And it generated so much publicity right after the talk. It's basically all over the newspapers and all over the radio and all over television, that the Ministry of Environment at the time, and we had a minister who was not very effective in terms of protecting natural resources. He was much more effective in terms of parceling them out for sale. He came out immediately and denounced everything I had said in my talk, even though he wasn't there, and said, you know, this is all untrue. And to look at the Dominican Republic, we've had growth of forest over the years, and this guy just doesn't know what he's talking about. And the reaction was so fierce against those comments and against the Ministry of Environment that less than a month later, when they had the change of administration, they changed the Minister of Environment. And in some ways, we helped influence that. I wouldn't say, you know, I think the major driver of that change was that the Dominican public was so outraged that we were able to show what was happening, and yet, that these issues were, you know, happening, and they were denying them. They were saying it wasn't happening at all. And so that really kind of changed the drama quite a bit, changed all the conversation publicly. And then, you know, from there, the new minister has come in the first week on the job. He watched the film with me in a private screening. He's come out and really gone aggressively after the charcoal trafficking, has talked about it, the need to do, sustainable forestry projects for alternative livelihoods for people in the countryside. They're putting a lot more resources into the national parks. And so a lot of this happened, I would say, partially because of the film, but also in a big way because the public was so outraged that this was happening. And that was kind of the reaction we wanted. You know, at first, the reaction of the government was basically like, none of this is true. And then when it got so obvious that it was true, and that there were these things happening, that that really they needed to make a change in the ministry, and the language of the government and the language and the attitude of the people in the government has changed a lot. Now, there's still a lot to be done in the Ministry of Environment. They still are under-resourced. They still don't get enough of a budget. There's still quite a few bad eggs in the ministry that, you know, have allowed these things to happen over the last decade, but and are still there operating because they're, you know, powerful political players or whatever. But for the most part, you know, there's been a major change and a major shift in attitude, and I think we have somewhat to do with that.
That's really amazing. I mean, that's, you know, sort of your ultimate goal as a filmmaker is to have some direct influence over the topic that you're covering in the story. And so really cool to hear that, you know, the film is already influencing the direction of this issue. So you've just started screening the film outside of the DR, right? What's sort of the plan for distribution? And I mean, how are things progressing, you know, on a larger scale as far as, you know, showing audiences outside of the Dominican Republic this film?
So we had our festival, our world premiere at Hot Docs Film Festival in Toronto in May, and then we had our U.S. premiere at Seattle International Film Festival in June, and we actually were really honored. We won the Best Documentary, the jury prize for Best Documentary in Seattle. And then we've been in close to a dozen film festivals in Europe, South America, and United States, and including the Dominican Environmental Film Festival that you attended, and now we've had a theater premiere in the Dominican Republic, and we had the film for 3 weeks in Dominican theaters. We are on 7 different screens, and then I've been personally doing all kinds of private screenings for political groups, for business groups, for small associations, for schools, for universities, and basically trying to get the message out and trying to get this film and the messages behind the film as much as we can into people's hands. So we've been pushing it hard. We'll have our television premiere in December on Univision. And we've had participation in Doc NYC, which is a incredibly important film festival in New York City. So that'll be our New York premiere. And then we're in 2017. We're still deciding and still determining what the U.S. television distribution will look like, and then from there streaming and on demand. So we've got kind of a big future ahead of us. We're pretty excited about the prospects. You know, we've got a lot of things that we've done up to now. It's already had a huge impact in the Dominican Republic. We're already developing a plan because we want to share this film in Haiti as much as possible. So we've done two screenings in Port-au-Prince in Haiti. We have a number of partners there that we're working on developing sort of different programs with them. So we have all kinds of ideas in our head, and we're really, pretty enthusiastic about the prospects for the film to continue having, as much impact as we can.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's always great to hear about a film project like this, really playing a significant role and influencing the outcome of these issues. So really awesome to hear about all those successes. So, my final question for you is, we talked a lot about, how you came to become involved in this film. And, this was your first film. You didn't really have a background in filmmaking beforehand. Are you going to make another film? Are you converted to a filmmaker now? What are your plans for the future?
So, I think my primary job right now is trying to figure out, what is the best way to have this film that we've made continue to have as big an impact as possible, both in the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and also in other places. And so we're continuing to do screenings and festivals and trying to get the word out. We've been publishing op-ed pieces and articles in the Dominican Republic regularly. So that's our immediate goal. And then, the idea of film for me, it's a powerful tool for environmental awareness, for creating social change. And so I think it's something I want to continue with, although I don't have a specific project right now in mind, because I'm really trying to concentrate all my efforts in Death by a Thousand Cuts.
Gotcha. Fair enough. Sounds like you've got a lot on your plate right now as far as this film project is going on. So really awesome to hear about this film project that you're working on, and also all the work that you're involved with in out in Punta Cana and the ecotourism business. Yeah, really, really great to chat with you, Jake. Thanks a lot for coming on the show.
I really appreciate it, and thanks so much for your time and for your interest both in Death by a Thousand Cuts and in our work in Grupo Punta Cana.
All right, that was our interview with filmmaker and conservationist Jake Keel. It's really amazing to hear about the level of influence that Jake's story has already had within the Dominican Republic. It sounds like there has already been a really dramatic shift in the government's approach towards addressing this issue, which is really amazing to hear. More than anything else, I love hearing about success stories like this, where the true power of a well-told story is revealed. It gives me hope for the future and reinvigorates my motivation to continue producing video content focused on conservation. If you want to learn more about Jake's film, Death by a Thousand Cuts, as well as his work with Punta Cana in the Dominican Republic, you can head over to the show notes page for this episode, where we'll have a list of relevant links. Those show notes can be found at wildlensinc.org/EOC98. That's wildlensinc.org/EOC98. If you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice. And if you really want to show us some love, you can leave us an honest rating and review on iTunes. Just search for Eyes on Conservation in the iTunes store. The Eyes on Conservation podcast is a production of Wild Lens. Today's episode was produced by myself, your host, Matt Podolsky, and edited by Serena Simons. Our theme music is by The Humidors.